From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest on this edition of the program is Julia Friedlander. She is Senior Fellow and Director of the Economic Statecraft Initiative in the Geoeconomics Center at the Atlantic Council, and that's a think tank here in Washington. She previously served as Senior Policy Advisor for Europe in the Office of Terrorism and Financial Intelligence at the U.S. Department of Treasury. She worked closely with European Union partners on global sanctions policy and combating illicit finance. We have invited Julia Friedlander to discuss the purpose behind and impact of the unprecedented raft of severe sanctions that the United States, along with its European allies, have imposed on Russia for its unprovoked and unlawful invasion of Ukraine. Recently, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky dismissed an official statement by the Kremlin saying that Russia will curtail its attacks in the Kyiv and Chernihiv areas and vowed to continue defensive military efforts. U.S. President Joe Biden reacted to the Russian pledge to limit operations near Kyiv by saying, quote, "I don't read anything into it until I see what their actions are." Close quote. President Biden affirmed that he and allies had no intention of lifting sanctions against Moscow at this stage. Julia Friedlander has built an impressive career in security and economic relations with a focus on trade, financial policy, and investment security. According to the Atlantic Council website, from 2007 to 2019, she was director for the European Union, Southern Europe, and Economic Affairs at the National Security Council. Prior to these roles, Julia held multiple analytical positions for the Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA, with an emphasis on global economic stability and energy security. So we look forward to speaking with Julia about the geopolitical implications of the economic sanctions leveled against Russia, including loopholes, drawbacks, and the challenge of sustaining them over a sufficient period, given differences of opinion among the European coalition. And Julia Friedlander joins us via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me and for the wonderful introduction.
Well, Julia, let's step back for a minute and examine the purpose of sanctions as a tool of diplomacy. Given your vast experience in the field, what role do economic sanctions play in the panoply of tools to both punish and isolate an adversary, in this case Russia, or coerce said adversary into making concessions?
Thank you. And I'll start out by saying that sanctions traditionally have been used, as you mentioned, in collaboration with potential military options as well as diplomatic pressure. But increasingly, the practice of sanctions is to stand in for a military option itself. So over the past several decades, especially after 9/11, the U.S. government and increasingly many of its international partners have turned to financial and economic pressure to change the behavior of governments. Now, what's changed over time is the move between cutting off specific nodes of illicit finance. So think about taking money away from terrorists after 9/11 to trying to change the behavior of entire governments. Now, this is not something that's completely unique to the post 9/11 era. There were long-term embargoes that were in place multilaterally, often within the UN framework with regards to apartheid in South Africa, or throughout the duration of the Cold War during the Soviet period. And many of those sanctions are thought to have executed a slow burn on South Africa and the Soviet Union and helped complement diplomatic means to bring an end to those regimes. What we're seeing now is the desire to make sanctions work at an increasingly fast tempo. So if you think about how the U.S. put pressure on Venezuela, this is after Maduro refused to leave power after he lost an election, or to isolate Iran and prevent it from being able to refine nuclear materials. These are all political processes that have been influenced through financial means by cutting off the specific resources that these governments would use to pursue their policies or military engagement, as in the case of Russia today, or to put pressure on them in general to coerce them back to a negotiating table. So again, what's very unique about this, especially today, is that sanctions, right, they're financial regulatory tools. You're blocking banks and commercial institutions from doing business with governments or particular individuals. This is is an intervention in commercial markets, in capital markets, and indeed often in free trade, but you're using those means to try to affect a military or political outcome. And as we can talk about through the course of this podcast, why or why that might not work.
Thanks for that excellent background, Julia. And as you alluded to, in lieu of so-called boots on the ground, NATO and EU countries have imposed what analysts say are among unparalleled sanctions on Russia for its unlawful invasion of a sovereign country, Ukraine. And before we get into the nitty-gritty, as you said, whether they're working or not, can you please remind us of the exact sanctions that the United States, NATO, and other allies have imposed on Russia, such as like on the central bank, banning banks from the SWIFT system and so forth, and assess their impact so far, more than 1 month into this conflict?
Sure. But I think first we have to go back to 2014, because this is when this began, right? This is when Russia, February 2014, first illegally annexed Crimea and then continued an incursion into the Donbass. And when Western countries first considered how we would sanction a country as large as Russia. Again, many of our sanctions campaigns previously had isolated small regional partners, but the idea of putting a lot of financial pressure on a major economy was a big deal. And it also was a big deal because the United States and Russia have been trying to figure out relations and trying to stabilize them with more or less success since 1991. Many of the tools that were designed then, we refer to them as sectoral sanctions or blocking of debt and equity. These are all things that were born in 2014 out of the initial invasion and are now being built on today. Now, many people sort of go back and forth and we argue as to whether 2014 sanctions worked or not. Were they too strong? Not strong enough? Did we not scale them appropriately to Russia's behavior? And people say, okay, maybe Putin would have decided to go further had he not been met with an astonishing amount of Western resolve back in 2014. Now, the assumption being that the interests among the US and its European allies are going to be too divergent for all of them to agree. And in the EU, there needs to be unanimity on all sanctions measures. So that means that 27 different countries, all with different foreign policies or different financial exposures, have to agree to these measures. And so from the Russian perspective, you pick off one and you pick off the whole project. So unity is very important. So when Russia is met with unity, it's a sign that we really, really care. So the 2014 sanctions were a preface for what we see today, as sanctions on some oligarchs, sanctions on some businesses, and some interventions in financial markets. After Russia began its full invasion, essentially 8 years later, we have taken those sanctions from 2014 and blown the top off of them, both in the scope of the measures, the severity of them, but also the time it takes. So in 2014, we had to figure out what legal authorities we needed to do this. We needed to write those legal authorities. We also needed to put together the actual packages. When you're trying to meet the legal threshold to sanction someone, there's a lot of background work that goes into that. It has to be reviewed by several different parts of the United States government, including the Department of Justice for its legality. So it takes time to put these things into place. So there was a delay between Russia's behavior and the political agreement and then the legal threshold to put sanctions in place. Now, in 2022, the Biden administration saw what the Russians were doing. They saw that over the course of months that they were surrounding the Ukrainian border with troops and preparing for what happened. And so they had the time to message to Russia that we are preparing to hit you hard if you do this. And then on the back end to do all the homework that's necessary so that when in the event that Russia does go in, you can respond immediately. And they did respond absolutely immediately. And that includes blocking of Russia's major banks. Almost all of them are under some sort of restriction, a full block of debt and equity, including on the secondary market. And so that's weeds for saying that you can't trade Russian debt between two third parties. And then also a ream of restrictions on individuals, including Putin himself. Usually when you sanction the head of state, it's saying you are no longer the legitimate leader of that country. So that's a huge symbolic measure. And then what turns out to be ultimately like the big red button in an Austin Powers movie, this is sort of the metaphor I'm using for this, which is to freeze all of Russia's foreign exchange holdings in G7 country jurisdiction. So the reason why that this is impactful, first, is that It happened very quickly, essentially overnight. G7 countries made this decision. Again, this is not to be underestimated because unity is hard, and froze 60% of what is referred to as Russia's war chest that's held abroad. And this is important when you think about what petrostates do. So Russia is a petrostate, just like Iran is a petrostate, Venezuela is a petrostate. Their export revenue is essentially all oil and gas, with exceptions. We can also talk about minerals and grain, which also play a big role in this crisis. But essentially, if you're a country like Russia, it's going to be safe to stick your assets in another jurisdiction that's a stable financial market. Now, after 2014, because they saw how we reacted last time, they decided to try to de-dollarize, right, to hold fewer dollars. And so when we froze these assets, the United States only had 8.5% of the foreign exchange. Europe and Japan and international financial institutions held the bulk of it. So really what this shows is that the United States was not the major actor here, maybe pushed for it politically, but financially, it was actually the like-minded countries together that were able to execute this. What does freezing the reserves of a country do? It blocks a country's access to foreign currency, to exchange, and that means that it's very hard to uphold the value of your own currency at home, because the Russian ruble is a traded currency. Its value depends upon its traded value internationally. And so what you see is a potential currency crisis unfolding, a potential liquidity crisis unfolding. And when that happens and banks go into crisis, what you also see is that the reserves are not there to service external debt. So the money that Russia has borrowed from America or for Europe. And so what we're seeing now is that Russia may also face some form of sovereign debt crisis. So far, Russia came into this crisis in a very good fiscal position. They were running a primary surplus, which is something that Western countries don't do because we spend a lot of money on social services that Russia doesn't. And also oil prices were very, very high. So Russia was in a good position going into this. So they're able to use a lot of tools such as capital controls to redenominate export revenue in ruble and use that money to prop up the financial system and the currency. And so far, given the ongoing oil and gas revenue that's coming into the country, Russia has been able to stave off the worst of a financial crisis or a sovereign crisis. But that might only just be for now. And I can certainly go into some of the longer term implications, which is that Russia may be an uninvestable jurisdiction for a decade. Right? Because with Western companies pulling out and with a lot of export controls, and we talk about sanctions a lot, but a lot of what's going to hurt the Russian economy over the longer term is the lack of access to component materials, to high-end components like chips, to refined petroleum. Anything that's going to contribute to their military-industrial complex has been essentially blocked by Western parties. And so you're seeing the 11th largest economy in the world, right, a G20 country, essentially being kicked back to some form of the 1990s period after the Soviet Union collapsed. And the impacts of that have not yet been felt fully in Russia. And it might very well be that Putin's advisors are not giving him the cold, hard truth because they're afraid, but that the Russian economy is on a very steep downward tack, about a 15 to 20% contraction in the coming year. For reference, over the course of the Great Depression in the United States, there was a drop in 5%. Okay, so Russia is in for some very hard times. The concept is, how much time do you leave to let these sanctions have their full effect? But that, of course, leaves more time for Russia to commit more atrocities in Ukraine. Do you want to tack on more to try to pressure them even more and keep the pressure up, especially since Russia has somewhat stabilized the economy for now? And how do you judge that effectiveness? And I think that, you know, most sanctions experts would say right now, you know what, the effects of these sanctions haven't fully been felt yet. And we don't know whether adding more on at this time would have an additional impact on Russia's calculus or ability to perpetrate the war. And so what I think is open for debate now, ultimately, though I don't think governments are able to articulate it, is this conversation about whether we need to see the Russian economy fully collapse before Putin is forced back to a real negotiating table, not necessarily the one that his parties are sitting around in Turkey right now. You need to put him in much more of a position of weakness, greater weakness, before he is compelled to negotiate on something that the Ukrainians are willing to accept.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Julia Friedlander, Senior Fellow and Director of the Economic Statecraft Initiative in the Geoeconomics Center at the Atlantic Council. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal Twitter follower from Serbia who goes by the name Lakisha. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter. Well, back to our conversation with Julia about the impact of sanctions on Russia. And Julia, here's a quick quote from the Washington Post from Sunday. It says, quote, "To be sure, the economic wall around Russia is not impregnable. Russia retains significant leverage over Europe because of its vast petroleum reserves. Eastern oil and gas are still flowing into key European markets for now and continue to generate billions of dollars in foreign currency each week, a financial lifeline for the Putin regime." And it goes on to say that the sanctions we have placed are meant to starve the Russian economy. And this is from Mr. Schott of the Peterson Institute. "But exceptions for oil and gas imports into Europe are a large feeding tube that's keeping the Russian economy afloat," unquote. So what is your take on that assessment, the fact that despite the impact of sanctions and their future impact, perhaps that this oil and gas is a loophole and it is keeping the Russian economy going?
I agree. And it's more than a loophole. It's a major carve out. All of the sanctions that the U.S. has put in place on the banking sector are licensed to allow for any kind of energy transaction. Now, this was done largely at the request of European allies. But this goes back to what I was saying a few minutes ago about the lifeline. Is the purpose of the sanctions to sever the lifeline, to call our sanctions efficient, to say that they are effective? Do we need to see Russia collapse? And that is a question. And do we want to see Russia collapse? Do we actually want to face the facts of the largest physical country in the world and the 11th largest economy in the world collapsing entirely, and that there are going to be big global ramifications for this? And so I think that in the heat of the moment, in our anger, we want to punish them as much as possible. But I think that the calculations about the long-term impacts of this has also not been done. And we might also be losing the strategy on what measures respond to what behavior. Because at the beginning of the crisis, we thought that this was going to be over in days, and Russia probably thought so too. And so we ended up overestimating their capabilities and underestimating the ability of the Ukrainians to fight back. And that's also because we underestimated perhaps how quickly we would arm the Ukrainians and how quickly we would get those arms to Ukraine. And so we were in a position where we had to use the strongest measure possible, what I mentioned, the foreign exchange reserves. Anything after that is going to be relatively less impactful. The one thing, the big thing that remains, besides U.S. secondary sanctions, are the oil and gas markets. Absolutely. And, you know, the U.S., Canada, U.K. are all have the luxury of saying we're not going to buy anymore because of different supplies and domestic supply, especially for Canada, right? So there is a certain element of countries should do what they can, but that understanding has to be there for the economies that just cannot wean themselves off Russian oil and gas overnight.
Exactly. And in that same article by the Washington Post on March 27, it says, quote, "Europe is dependent on Russian oil and gas today, but they have already announced plans to wean off a good share of its gas imports from Russia in the coming year." And this is from the Peterson Institute, Mr. Schott. So, again, you know, it's a long-term process, but I have a question for you with respect to secondary sanctions. Please explain that term and how important they are.
Sure. Yeah. No, and I was going to offer to do that. So secondary sanctions are the ability to threaten punishment on any third party that does business with a sanctioned entity. So the conversation right now is, are we going to sanction India or China or any other global economy for doing business with an entity in Russia that we have sanctioned? And so it's a really powerful tool. It's based on the need for all global economies to transact in dollars and clear dollars through New York markets. But it's also a potentially really damaging one because a lot of countries, I mean, all countries pretty much, say that this is extraterritorial, that they are not required to comply with this U.S. law. And there are a lot of sort of political and economic ramifications and blowbacks on that, like efforts to completely work outside of the U.S. dollar and the creation of alliances between countries that have been targeted by secondary sanctions. So it's a really powerful tool. The parts of the U.S. government have said that they are considering it. I mean, of course, it's a natural escalation measure when looking for further things to do in the Russia conflict. But again, just a major caveat, there are major geopolitical costs to using them.
Absolutely. Could you just quickly describe what some of those costs might be before I ask another question?
So, for example, right now, China is walking a fine line between the political allegiance that it has sworn to Russia and the financial realities of doing business with a collapsing economy and the desire to maintain access to U.S. dollar markets, which they need to. Major commercial banks need dollars. So if China is deciding whether to extend Russia a line of credit commercially or a swap line via the central banks, the threat of secondary sanctions might dissuade them to think otherwise. But when we're trying to make outreach to China to say, you have no financial interest in extending a line of credit to a country that's collapsing and therefore you'll lose your money, or appeal to some sort of better angel, don't support a country that's invading another country. If we're trying to make those diplomatic efforts, then it is damaging to at the same time threaten punishment on them publicly. You can do it in private. But publicly, if you say, we are going to sanction you for doing business with Russia, then it's harder politically for China to then quietly back away from acting on its sworn political allegiance.
We know that China has not gone along with the sanctions, but there are some other countries I'd like you to comment on. For example, India continues to maintain a supportive relationship with Russia despite international isolation of the Kremlin. It gets its lion's share of military equipment from Moscow. And then there's Israel, which appears to be hedging. You know, it says it supports Ukraine, but refrains from severing ties with Russia, saying it depends on Moscow for its so-called freedom of action in Syria, and that it does not have a sanctions law. To what extent do these countries undermine the effectiveness of the broad sanctions meant to isolate Russia?
I mean, I think it depends upon how you define undermine, right? I mean, we want to multilateralize this as much as possible. But using the word undermine is really from an American perspective. I mean, think about how India sees this, okay? It's not only the weapons that it buys from Russia. It's oil that it gets from Russia that it can't necessarily afford to get from other places, and fertilizer. Fertilizer is the big thing that they import from Russia that they can't necessarily source otherwise. India is a democracy, but it is also a poor country. And so there are economic ties to Russia that are irreplaceable for them. So I think that there has to be a little bit of, and there is, understanding for those realities that Western economies have the ability to take economic hits for sanctions that they implement, but that a country like India has certain needs that it can't replace. When it comes to Israel, it's a different calculation, as you say. Israel has placed itself as a mediator between Russia and Ukraine, having good relationships with both governments, based on histories of immigration, and has tried to mediate. And in that regard, you don't want to be a party to those sanctions if you're going to be mediating. The other issue is Syria, which poses a direct threat to Israel, and the realities that Russian interventions in Syria have helped quell some pockets of those threats, specifically regarding Al-Qaeda. Of course, who knows whether Russia's support to the Syrian regime itself helps Israel? That's doubtable. But the actual Russian interventions against terrorist groups within Syria does help quell some security concerns in Israel. So they have a very careful security line to draw there as well.
That's a very interesting response. And it's important to have a nuanced view. I refer to an intelligence brief by the Sufan Center saying, quote, at the strategic level, India and U.S. leaders see India's engagement with Moscow as helping reduce Russia's economic and political dependence on Beijing. So, of course, that's another geopolitical aspect. So it's not so black and white. But let's talk about the so-called loopholes, Julia Friedlander. But do you see any loopholes? And, you know, what about some Russians abroad who are, you know, caught in this crossfire of sanctions? Some of them are trying to do good. support Ukraine, but their assets are being frozen. And how do you see these so-called contradictions affecting our sanctions regime?
Well, I think it's a question about, again, that a lot of countries around the world are going to want to wait and see what happens, that they don't want to have to take sides in this, either for political reasons or economic ones. That's because when you use finance and economics as tools of war, you're expanding the breadth of who is a party to this conflict, either witting or unwitting or willing or unwilling, because of the nature of globalized markets. And so what some of these sanctions end up doing is potentially hitting countries hard that had no intention of being part of this. You know, Russia and Ukraine export 25% of the world's wheat supply, and that has potentially creating a humanitarian food crisis in North Africa and parts of the Middle East. And so these are countries that are going to be like, we need our grain, right? And therefore, we're not going to be trying to make the situation worse for ourselves. And so when it comes to sort of trade, trade overall is a much more complicated interweb of supply chains and countries and dependencies. When it comes to financial markets, however, because there aren't that many countries in the world that have deep financial markets whose currencies wield a lot of power, that's the dollar, the euro, the pound, the Swiss franc, the yen in Japan, these are reserve currencies or holders of value. That means that sanctions within the financial realm can be extremely effective when coordinated among those powers. Loopholes will depend upon whether you call it a loophole or whether you call it a carve-out. Energy is a carve-out right now based on European and Japanese dependencies. But then also, I think what you're referring to is just sort of the illicit finance risk, money laundering.
Yes.
Yes. The Russians are very good at laundering money, and we noticed an increase in that since 2014, trying to move assets further out of the reach of authorities because they know that we're looking for them. And so the Russians traditionally use a broad network of shell companies and offshore jurisdictions and financial service providers to move assets. Essentially, they can move around the world at the speed of light and ultimately are stored in Western jurisdictions to be safe from being recouped by the Kremlin or being seized by local government. So I think that there is an aspect of the pilfering of Russian state assets, right? These oligarchs, you know, in many ways, you have to consider them as arms of the Russian state because they have been essentially acting as, you know, siphons off of Russian wealth, right? Money and assets that should be held in Russia and poured into the Russian economy, given back to the Russian people, have essentially been stolen by these individuals and stored abroad. And so this has been ongoing for decades, but now is even more pertinent because a lot of this money that you're trying to sensibly like cut off Russia's well is already in our jurisdiction, hidden, notionally linked to this group of individuals. And so that's why sanctioning oligarchs is important. And then using those sanctions as a kicking off point for a lot of financial and law enforcement investigations to find where this money is and hopefully freeze it. So that's the big loophole. I think when you say that some of these individuals are pledging their allegiance to Ukraine, there are multiple reasons to do that. One is because they actually, now that they're out of the country, do not agree with the Kremlin's policies. That's the more charitable option. And the less charitable option is that they're trying to say, don't touch me. Try to dissuade investigators from looking into them because they're not the bad guys after all.
As we close, just to sum up your take on how these sanctions are having the intended impact so far and what could be the next step if we can't bring this horrible invasion to an end.
Well, I think the pessimistic look is that ultimately the U.S. and the West might have to accept a quote-unquote solution, a ceasefire, at least in Ukraine, that is a cold war within that country. And whether a territory is divided up between notionally Russia-controlled and Ukrainian-controlled, these are all the harsh realities that I think we're facing. But I think that in terms of the sanctions themselves, the medium to long-term impact on Russia has not landed yet. And that over the medium term, you know, if we're in a standoff, we're preparing for years of conflict, hot or not as hot, that the sanctions will deplete Russia of their resources and that the West will remain unified in upholding those sanctions. We've mentioned some of the escalation options already. That is, you do touch energy, but that Europe will take, as you referenced, referenced, a very drastic tack at economic cost to reduce its dependency on Russia. The European Commission plan calls for a 2/3 reduction over the course of the coming year. That is going to take a huge hit to Russia, because when they turn and try to sell those resources to other parts of the world, there are going to be physical impediments, the physical distance between Western Russia and Eastern China, but also that those countries are going to have the position to negotiate a huge discount. And that's actually what India is doing right now. So I think that energy is one option. Other options include further sanctioning of banks, particularly in Europe, sanctioning of more companies in Russia, and then the tripwire of secondary sanctions if governments decide we really have to go there.
Julia Friedlander is Senior Fellow and Director of the Economic Statecraft Initiative in the Geoeconomic Center at the Atlantic Council. Julia, thank you so much for your time and excellent analysis. We greatly appreciate it.
Of course. Thanks for having me on.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.